our greatest challenge as a global society is reorienting towards a value system that actually frames our relationship to water, not as one of ecosystem services, beneficial uses, but of stewardship, of conservation, and of relationality.
Lao Tzu wrote, "Water is fluid, soft, and yielding. But water will wear away rock, which is rigid and cannot yield." This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. I think of this quote whenever I reflect on the tremendous water challenges and conflicts that people face around the world. These are conflicts created by the rigid worlds of industry and imperialism, which despite their might will never overcome the reality of water. We need it. And if we are to succeed in building a better world, we need to learn or relearn how to relate to it. With this in mind, I am speaking today with Dr. Kelsey Leonard, a member of the Shinnecock Nation and faculty member at the University of Waterloo. Every time I speak with Kelsey, I feel as though my eyes have been opened, and this conversation is no different. We talk about recognizing water's personhood, decolonization, and democratizing water governance. Let's dig in. I am joined today by Dr. Kelsey Leonard. Kelsey is a water scientist, a legal scholar, a policy expert and writer, and an enrolled citizen of the Shinnecock Nation, whose territories are today referred to by many as Eastern Long Island. Her work focuses on Indigenous water justice and its climatic, territorial, and governance underpinnings for our shared sustainable future. She also has a fantastic TED Talk on why water should have the same rights as humans. Kelsey, thank you very much for joining me today, and it's great to speak with you again.
Tabutni, thank you. I'm so happy to be here with you.
In your TED Talk, you start by talking about an Anishinaabe prophecy shared with you by a mentor of a future when an ounce of water will become worth more than an ounce of gold. With climate change, predictions of water scarcity, drought in the West and elsewhere in the world, where I'm currently in the West and still experiencing tremendous drought, and also tremendously wasteful water management practices that we see all over the developed world, can you speak some to how you see our present global predicament regarding water? What are you most concerned about, or how do you frame the problems?
Yes, and these are really, you know, complex. Sometimes in the water policy world, we call them wicked wet problems. And the challenge, I think, is also in our orientation of framing questions. It's in the way in which we conceptualize our relationship to water, or maybe in a larger context, the lack of any relationship to water, the objectification, the commodification of water, where water becomes only a resource, an environmental service for the benefit, consumption, and use by humans. And I think for us right now, our greatest challenge as a global society is reorienting towards a value system that actually frames our relationship to water, not as one of ecosystem services, beneficial uses, but of stewardship, of conservation, and of relationality.
So sort of building on that notion of relationality, in your TED Talk, you also say, and I'm quoting you here, that one of the many solutions to solving the many water injustices we see in our world today is recognizing that water is a living relation and granting it the legal personhood it deserves. You say that rather than asking what is water, we should change our orientation to who is water. And so can you tell me a bit about what it would mean to acknowledge personhood and moral standing for water, you know, practically, symbolically? Why would that be such a big change in terms of our relationship between sort of modern contemporary society and water?
I think it would be a radical change for the modern dominant water regimes, because in actuality, we set the bar really low for how we manage water today globally. We set that bar to be the bare minimum of what humans need for consumption and use and recreation and sort of drinking, fishing, you know, drinkable, swimmable, fishable is sort of the go-to moniker. And even that was a fight. To get that was a big fight in the conservation management space. And now we're probably there where we all sort of globally, you know, have a moral leaning towards, yes, water should be drinkable, fishable, and swimmable. But that bar is really low. So when we think about acknowledging the inherent rights of water to be a living entity, to exist, thrive, to naturally evolve, we're actually saying as a global society, water deserves more. We need to set the bar higher. We need to acknowledge that water should have a healthy ecosystem in totality that is more holistic, more so than just what do humans need to thrive and be beneficiaries of that drinkable, fishable, swimmable ecosystem, but what do other living entities in addition to the water itself need to be healthy and thrive?
Expanding that ethical space and extending it to a plethora of our non-human, other than human neighbors.
You know, another part of this big challenge is that we imagine ourselves, you know, stemming from the Enlightenment period of sort of Western philosophers, we imagine ourselves as separate from nature, when in reality, we are a part of nature. And we have to be working towards being a part of that larger system rather than separate and dominating over it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think when I hear you talking about this, I think of all of the conflict over any number of different environmental resources, you know, conflict over fisheries, conflict over water, and you know, extending the same rights that you and I have to water, it strikes me also repositions water as a party to the conflict, not the subject of the conflict. But then in thinking about it that way, then I feel compelled to ask, who then speaks for or on behalf of the water when it comes to managing conflicts? And is it the, you know, when you extend rights, does it become the role of the state? Does it become the role of every one of us? Does, you know, do you see what I'm getting at with this question?
Yes, I do. And it is a common question that's asked in the context of earth law, earth jurisprudence, the recognition of the inherent rights of nature is, you know, within our complex and legally pluralistic society, who then has the right to be that voice for nature? And I would say that the answer in a very legal form is it depends. And it should. That's not an evasive answer. It's an answer to say we have to put in the work as locals, communities, and societies to build locally the context-specific measures of enforcement and guardianship that would identify who or which collectives are the best fit and match for that particular ecosystem to speak in its best interest. In some instances, it may be Indigenous peoples solely and Indigenous led. In others, it may be a mixture of all different folks from all different backgrounds. But again, there's no one size fits all. And we're, I think, at a stage in the global movement of earth law where we are seeing new innovative pathways emerge for how to set up and establish these guardianship mechanisms.
I really appreciate that answer and that there's no one size fits all, because it's so easy to default to assuming there's a simple answer there. And you know, you mentioned people putting in the work, and I'm thinking about all of the work that is being put in by Indigenous peoples in North America, in Canada, you know, the Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs who are trying to protect their traditional headwaters of their land from the Coastal GasLink. And it strikes me that if we acknowledged the personhood, in this case, for example, of these headwaters and the responsibility in this case, or the role of the hereditary chiefs speaking on behalf of the water, we'd be having a very different conversation about the pipeline. But here we are, and you know, the government's proceeding with the RCMP in force to continue to try to push this through. And so how do we make more ground on this? Is it, are we waiting on legal action? Are we, you know, what's the next step, do you think, to make a little bit more ground on changing the way we address and resolve these kinds of issues?
I feel like that's the million-dollar question. And the difficulty is I don't think there is one pathway towards the reduction of water conflict globally. I think it's a multi-scalar process. I think it also needs to involve diverse actors. And that's probably the first step, is the democratization. And there's a wonderful water governance scholar, Dr. Farhana Sultana, who talks about this in the context of, we need more democratization of water governance. And what that means is we need more women involved in water governance. We need Indigenous peoples involved. We need a reform and a reimagining of the design of water governance for the future of our societies. And so I think if we can amplify more voices like Dr. Farhana and others who are calling for this democratization across both the developed and, you know, the global South and the global North and, you know, the world over, and say we need more localized context specific water management regimes and approaches to water governance, then we might start to see a reduction in conflict. But it is a very difficult space right now to imagine what the futurity looks like.
Now, Kelsey mentioned Dr. Farhana Sultana, who is a remarkable and internationally recognized scholar on the topic of water governance and justice. In the interest of elevating her voice, I asked her to record a short excerpt from a paper titled Water Justice. Here she is.
The remarkable thing about water is that it seeps across all boundaries and all aspects of life, as it is simultaneously social, economic, political, institutional, cultural, spiritual, and ecological. To advocate for water justice, we need to think critically and commit to making changes in our lives and advocating for others. Getting involved in local and regional water justice efforts can be a good start, but this requires recognition that water justice is never only local, but cross-scalar and global. It is also critical to pay attention to the ways that water is about gender, class, race, ethnicity, identity, and place, and appreciate how it is linked to broader issues of social justice. Such action and advocacy can foster collectivizing, alliances, and working with others to promote equity, human rights, and justice. The first step, though, is to commit and remain engaged and thereby become a water warrior. Galvanizing other water warriors can create transformations that we need.
Now, galvanizing water warriors is something that I can get behind. Now back to the interview. So Kelsey, is there something, even if it's difficult to imagine, is there something that you're encouraged by?
I think I am encouraged by the Earth Law movement, by these local resolutions and litigation efforts, and even not even at the local level, in some countries within the global South, we're seeing, you know, national legislation, constitutional amendments that are recognizing the inherent rights of nature and different natural entities. And I think that that is very promising for how, you know, maybe those recognitions came 5-10 years ago, and now we're actually seeing them being used in defense against extractive industries and further, you know, overdevelopment of different terrestrial as well as marine areas. And so I think these aspects of the movement do give me hope. I find I'm often inspired by young people and by elders, you know, climate strikes and, you know, fire drill Fridays, all of these different types of localized and international, really sort of localized actions that scale up to sort of have this international global impact are very inspiring and hopeful. But we still have a long way to go. And I think, you know, COP26 and, you know, the way in which the global science community, as well as sort of the global community of decision makers in terms of world leaders, they're still, the urgency is not fully being met yet. And there's only so much time left.
You mentioned in your previous answer, democratization, and it made me think of another word that I often see, including in Dr. Sultana's work and others' work around water, decolonization. And like democratization, decolonization is a word that's very easy to throw around, but in practice requires a much more earnest engagement, especially from settlers. And so I wonder, what do you think people misunderstand most when somebody talking, say, about, in this case, water, talks about decolonizing the approach, the understanding, the relationships? What do you think people misunderstand about that? Because sometimes I personally have found it to be just such a challenging concept to communicate to other settlers.
It's a really wonderful question. I actually had an interaction with a student recently where, from their positionality, they said, every time I hear decolonization, I hear that Indigenous peoples want to take something away from us. And I thought, you know, and they weren't saying it sort of maliciously or anything. They were just being honest about what resonated and what type of reflection came from their hearing of that word. And I felt like that reflection would resonate with so many settlers and non-Indigenous people around the world, that there's just something, some type of spark or light switch that gets turned on when they hear that word, where it feels like, oh, you're trying to take something away from me, when in reality, it's about adding something back in. And I think for me, decolonization in the space of water is not about taking away existing regimes or taking away, you know, the non-Indigenous people that exist in these water spaces, but about how do we add in more plurality of water knowledges. It's like the old adage, you know, the more minds that come together, the greater the types of innovation that can be sparked, right? If we work in isolation, we often don't come up with the most brilliant ideas. The most brilliant ideas are often stem from collaboration and collaborative design and discussion and conversation that sparks a critique, but also a rebuttal of intellectual thought and inquiry. And right now, what we're saying by having a colonized water regime is we are stifling the opportunity for the plurality of thought to coexist and give us new pathways of innovation for our water future.
And so it's not about taking something away, but adding something back in. I've not heard somebody ever put it that way before. And I really, it's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that story. So building on that answer, you know, I have become a proponent of working towards change through as many avenues as possible, and not just one simple solution, not just science, but activism and organizing and education. And, you know, as myself, a settler living in Canada, there's so much to contribute to. And so I'm thinking about the media landscape around the lobster fisheries in Canada, around the pipelines. And I'm thinking about how divided people get over activism, and in particular, Indigenous activism and resistance. And so if there's a question here for you, I'm curious, what kind of advice do you give to people trying to figure out, settlers in particular, where they fit in trying to sort of lean their shoulders in and help contribute to these causes?
I think one of the greatest ways to contribute is to actually be knowledgeable and aware of the territory that you now occupy. Who are the Indigenous peoples who have stewarded and continue to steward that land and those waters? And what are some of their most pressing challenges in the contemporary world? I think we like to imagine indigeneity within this fictitious past that furthers contemporary erasure. And so if we're going to speak out against that, allow for Indigenous visibility, then we actually, again, as I said earlier, communities and individuals have to put in the work to make visible Indigenous peoples, who they have historically, either consciously or unconsciously, complicitly complied to their erasure. And that's the first step, because if you don't even acknowledge the Indigenous peoples that are in your backyard, so to say, how are you going to know what their current and contemporary struggles are to be able to lend a hand? And not every hand lent is done so in a fashion that is actually helpful. Right? If you come into a community or to a community to assist and you have no knowledge of them, you're putting more work and burden on that community or on an individual from that community to educate you, when you need to do that as a first step before even being able to lend a hand. And I think there's just too many folks across the globe who just haven't put that work in yet to educate themselves. And it's not, you know, I recognize that that failure of education is not solely a burden that they bear of ignorance. It's one that's systemically built into colonialized education systems. But that's also a part of the, you know, what we might call a sort of a modern reconciliation process, is you have to acknowledge that deficit and work to fix it.
You reminded me, Kelsey, of, you know, a lesson that I've learned personally in my own work. You know, I talk about this in my book a little bit, but to stop trying to solve other people's problems, but help, but being willing to contribute to their solutions.
Yes. And I think we have, no matter what your background is, we all want to contribute to the world. Maybe we all have a varying levels of a savior complex, but we have to be able to acknowledge it, to hold it back, because sometimes that savior complex can do more harm than good. And I think the greatest lesson I've learned more recently in this work around water is sometimes your greatest contribution can be to listen. To listen to others who are on the front lines of climate change and the impacts thereof, but also to be able to listen to the water itself. There is so much that the natural world has to teach us in witnessing its resiliency in the face of climatic changes that we could learn from and be able to replicate and innovate therefrom.
Thank you for that, Kelsey. I have one final question for you for the show. And I'll tell you, I've been very much looking forward to asking you this question, because I pose it to all of my guests. What is the most radical change you'd like to see in your lifetime? And how close do you think we are?
There's so many radical changes I'd love to see in my lifetime. How do I pick just one? I mean, I think I'd be remiss not to say that the bold idea I still fervently cling to is the one presented in my TED talk. And that is that all water has inherent rights that should be recognized and lifted up and called in to how we make decisions about water as human beings. And that hopefully that radical change stems from a positionality where we prioritize the water's needs above our own. And I don't know if that's necessarily a radical change or a regenerative pathway to what we always knew to be true.
Thank you very much for taking a little bit of time with me and talking to me about this. I really appreciate your time and your answers.
Well, Tabutni, thank you so much for having me. It's been great to be in conversation with you.
This episode of the Second Transition Podcast was produced on the traditional lands and territories of the Washoe people in what is now known as Northern California. Funding for this podcast comes in part from the Errol Food Institute, from the University of Guelph, and from Voice Ed Radio. My guest today was Dr. Kelsey Leonard, and you can find her contact information in the episode notes. We also heard from Dr. Farhana Sultana from Syracuse University, and appreciate the time that she took to record that excerpt. Thanks for joining us.